I just want the artist to be happy with their release and it coming out. Not really streaming numbers, none of the lot of media attention. I just want them to be like, thank you so much. You did a great job. We're really happy. That's all I want with their release. And that is the best I can hope for, really. And also for a release to come out and me feel like I've done the best I could.
Hey, and welcome to this bonus episode of First Pressing with Matt Perrott. Across the 7 episodes, our regular host Mark has been catching up with local label heads to chat about Perth's music scene and the wonderful communities they nurture. My name is Matt Perrott. I'm the music director of RTRFM. And this fortnight, I've got the pleasure of shifting the spotlight onto Mark himself to find out more about Blue Grey Pink Records.
Because we'd kind of identified that there was a lot of bands doing it, that we were doing it, and there wasn't a label representing that in Perth at the time. If I get approached for management or something like that these days, it's like, could I see that other people recognised it was great too? My guts will pretty quickly be like, this is right. And then I'm like, is there an audience for this? I guess I just had time to just focus on what I'd learned and be a manager, and that was kind of exciting.
Blue Grey Pink aims to platform artists who showcase the diversity and talent of WA's vibrant sonic landscape and is fueled by a love of the local music community and Mark's desire to share knowledge with his friends and fellow artists. It was a great chat and I can't wait to share it with you. This is Mark Neal from Blue Grey Pink. Welcome, Mark Neal. How's it going?
Hey, Matt Perrott. Pleasure to be hanging out with you, talking about labels.
Absolutely. It is wonderful to be in studio. You're here. You started out as a manager and musician down in the Great South. You've done a whole lot of stuff with indie labels, bands, bookings, radio and festivals. You've stepped into the role of WhamFest director and then stepped out of that. Having just summed up your entire life for you.
Thanks.
Can you give me the real Mark Neal elevator pitch? What do you do now? Sort of, what's your label?
Hey, how's it going, mate?
Damn, I hate that question. You know, it's like the when I go to family functions and I haven't seen family in ages and they're like, hey, so what's going on? Or someone new in the family's like, what do you do? And I'm like, oh, where do I start on this? What do I say? Do I say I'm a manager? Or do I say I run a label? Or do I just say I work at a hamburger shop?
Do you work at a hamburger shop?
Actually, yeah. Kind of went broke last year on a festival. I often will say I run a label. And they ask me what that means. And I'll say, oh, we book some venues. We put out some records for bands, and I work in general music industry stuff. It really depends on how deep you want to go with that person asking that question.
I definitely asked it knowing that it's pretty loaded and has a very multifaceted answer, which can also sort of differ from individual to individual. So I guess we can like pair it back for the Mark Neal elevator pitch where all this started. And start with like a summary of your life and story and how you got into music. You're a teenager when you first got into music, learning how to play guitar at age 18. What got you interested? What was like the zeitgeist that captured you back in those late teens, fresh-faced and ready to take on the world?
Yep. You know, I kind of forgot that this was actually what this was going to be like. This is the same questions I've asked everyone on this label podcast, but I kind of forgot that we were doing it about me.
Yeah, the shoe's really on the other foot now, buddy.
I feel like I sat on the wrong microphone because I'm in the control microphone, but I shouldn't be. All right, yeah, let's go all the way back to baby Mark Neal. I don't know exactly when Like, I can't really remember what my first music memory was. Like, I don't know. Like, I've got some early memories of, like, or I have this really nice memories that are, like, these comfort things, right? You know, when like, my parents were having a party or something. And there was music playing and they were just having a great time, laughing and probably getting really drunk. And I was just in bed, comfortable, knowing that they were there, and I slept really well with that party noise going on. Do you know that feeling?
Yeah.
Is that a relatable feeling for other people?
It's kind of, it's that dull buzz, like a vibe.
Yeah.
Like, for want of a better word.
It's just like, you know you're safe, even though there's a ruckus going on, and it's like a good ruckus, and you know that you're safe in bed or something. Like, I don't know, it's just this yeah. thing, and music was there as like a part of it.
Yeah, my folks were never super into music to automatically turn it on to me, but I have similar memories, but with CSI Miami on in the background.
Yes. They had a party to CSI Miami.
Interesting family. So it doesn't even start with, like, latching on to sort of one artist or an action or a friend being like, oh, you want to join a band? It's just like the presence of music and
I think so. Yeah, I was just trying to think of what my earliest memory of, like, going, oh, music is party and comfort and yeah. And then, you know, as I, like, got older, I lived in Denmark, but I went to school in Albany, which was like an hour and a bit bus ride away, and I had a Discman. And I would just play CDs. I didn't have many friends on the bus, and I would just listen to albums over and over again for like almost 2.5 hours every day. And then, you know, as I grew up, it just became part of like my identity. I wasn't a sports kid, so it was just CDs and nu metal and you know, friends talking about different nu metal bands that were coming out, which was just a horrible genre to be in at the time, but I was all in it.
It's having a little bit of a resurgence.
It strangely is. Disturbingly, even.
So, there you go. You're a teenage tastemaker. Did a lot of, like, thought go into choosing those CDs and sort of engaging with that music when you were a teenager? Or was it, again, just something that was kind of there and a comfort in what you did?
Yeah, they were generally always my CDs. Like, I never dived into my dad's collection much, which I regret a little bit now, but then again, like, we share records and hang out a lot and talk about music, so that's, we still do that stuff. But it was whatever I had, and, you know, I didn't have a lot of money or many CDs, so they were just the same ones that I'd bought. And there was also that kind of weird thing, whereas if you bought a CD and you were like, no, that's not as good as I thought it was, you just kept listening to it until you liked it, and because you had to, because you didn't have another one.
Is it like buyer's remorse?
I think I do remember, like, going to a CD store, buying one, knowing that's the one I wanted, and then buying another one and not really caring, kind of it being a bit of a spur of the moment because I had enough money to buy multiple. And then you'd end up, like, just forgetting about the one that you didn't care about. But then when you put it on, you'd be like, huh, this is pretty good. And it'd become, like, one of your favorite albums.
And a beautiful double discovery. So how did you get from listening to nu metal on a Walkman down in between Denmark and Albany up to the metro area? What sparked that move? And was it still music or just like the classic, got to go up to Perth?
Yeah. So in high school, I didn't really play music. I took a bunch of lessons in like guitar and stuff, was terrible at it. Didn't pursue it very much. We did at one point in high school have a band where we covered Rage Against the Machine at some point, probably really badly. And I also had this, like, a couple of weird things happen through school. Sorry, I'm going to, like, do my whole life story. It's going to be, like, hours.
I'm asking you about your whole life story, so run with it.
We did a few music production, or no, not music, musical productions, and I was in backstage and quite good at it, or quite invested in it for some reason. I think because the teacher was cool. And you got to go on excursions and stuff. And I have this, like, I wonder if how much that has had an impact on my life as being like a behind the scenes guy. And then also at some point we won, I can't believe I'm going to say this, the Triple J high school competition they did, and Downside came to our school and they did a live broadcast from the gymnasium while Downside played and stuff, and there were people talking on the radio, and I remember being like, whoa, that's a thing. And now I hear it RTRFM doing radio.
Talking on the radio. It is indeed a thing.
I guess music was like part of my identity, even though I didn't play anything really well. And then after school, my parents were like, you have to get a trade or you have to study something, or like they had that kind of like that pressure of being young and having to learn something. And at some point I decided I was going to be a sound engineer. And I think they were very happy with that because engineer was in the title. And we came up and looked at Whopper and talked to people about it. And they were like, they were more experienced rather than grades was important. So I was able to like drop into the dumber classes at school and coast through. And then as soon as I finished high school, I went and did this music course in Denmark. And a lecturer there called Tony King, who I owe a lot to, taught me to play guitar and write songs, and I just kind of ran with it and was like, screw engineering, that's boring. I'm going to be a songwriter. And then I joined a band in Albany, lived there for a while, and maybe I didn't really join the band in Albany. I might have joined them once I was kind of in Perth. Or I met a bunch of songwriters through that course and started doing things and being more active. And then at some point I moved to Perth because you just got to move to Perth. You can't stay in Albany for that long. You'll go crazy. A friend had moved at the same time, and then I joined his band, or he had this idea for a band called Minute 36, which we did for many years. And I became kind of the manager guy just because I was pretty good at that. You know, I could send an email and I didn't care if we didn't get a reply or...
There's always one person in the band.
Yeah. I was that person in the band.
So... We're going to jump forward a little bit now. You've played in bands. You've had a little bit of success, I assume. I hope.
We had a bit of success. Like, Minute 36 got... We did a couple of weird things. Like, at some point, we moved back to Albany and all lived in the same house, which was a terrible idea. Probably why the reason the band broke up. But fun. And I have a lot of good memories of. But we also, like, We toured over east by driving because we had a double bass in the band and it was like impossible to fly a double bass. We would make money playing wineries and regional stuff, and we built up really good regional fans, whereas in Perth we didn't have anyone. But we got to do, like, we supported Carnival. At one point we went to Canada and played Canadian Music Week, and so we had a little bit of success.
Yeah, and a lot of stuff which involved a fair amount of organization, particularly if... You were that person in the band.
Yeah. And I kind of knew... It's a funny we're thinking back about it, because I feel like a lot of the reason that band never made it is because our communication sucked, and it just wasn't like... I felt like I didn't get enough cred from all the work I did, I think that's the reason I even left. I was like, fuck you guys. I work so hard. You just hang out, smoke cigarettes and play songs. And I probably should have done that. Should have just talked to them all.
I thought you meant you should have just hung out and smoked cigarettes more. just rolled with it all.
That's never a good idea.
People probably know you as or maybe don't know you as the big brain behind Blue Grey Pink. What's the origin of that label? We've heard about Minute 36.
Yep.
And the Mark Neal origin story.
The origin story. Yeah, so Blue Grey Pink started in around 2014 when... I was playing in The Disappointed at the time, and Michael Strong, who's a longtime collaborator of mine, he was a singer of The Disappointed, and I was kind of doing, again, I'd fallen into that manager role in a band that I was in. And at some point, he'd picked up this band that he was really into called Late Night Hysterics, who would eventually turn into Ryan Beano, who were a great band, and he'd recognized that they were really good. And I was started working with this band out of Northam called Girl York at the time. But I think they changed their names a couple of times, and trying to help them with a bit of management stuff. And we decided to make this label together and both, you know, combine our powers and release these two things. And it was kind of actually a competition. It was like he was going to... I was like, oh, this Girl York track's really well produced. It's going to do well. I could see it being like a banger for many stations. And he was like, I've got this track. It's going to be a banger. And we were kind of competing to see which song would do better. And he actually was right.
No.
Way better than Girl York. But they both did quite well for us. And so I think we decided to put a brand together just to, you know, have that thing at the bottom of posters that makes it look more official, or to be like something presents.
Yeah, nice little logo, something in an email signature.
Yeah, something that just makes it look like you're a proper thing and be able to launch something. Yeah, so that we started that with this very vague idea of he was going to record people and I would do the putting it out. And in that process, we kind of, you know, it was harder work than we thought. Michael realized that he just wanted to do the recording and all the other bits that came with it weren't his bag. And I was kind of learning to work with bands I wasn't in. So it kind of stopped for a while. But, you know, in the meantime, it was also the ABN that I operated other things I was doing. Like, I think at the time I was booking the Swan Hotel somewhere. I'd started the Beaufort Street Songwriters Club. So it kind of had this, it was still living on as this ABN and placeholder name for these other things I was running. That's where it started. And then eventually I like got back into working with other bands and started putting more stuff out.
So when you're sort of figuring out which bands you're going to work with, what's the selection process that you go through? Like what makes a blue, grey, pink artist, or even what made a blue, grey, pink artist then? And what makes it now to hit you with the double-barreled one?
Yeah, well, then it was very much like kind of pop, but off-center. Like whether it was like mixed with alt or rock or punk, but it was like there had to be this kind of more pop angle. And I think that was because we'd kind of identified that there was a lot of bands doing it, that we were doing it, and there wasn't a label representing that in Perth at the time. But now it's literally just people I like. And mostly my kind of friends. Like the reason it kind of kicked back up was it was just to help my friends put stuff out.
Yeah, I mean that's wonderful. So earlier you mentioned that like some of the extra work that got folded into that blue grey pink ABN was stuff with the Beaufort Street Songwriters Club, which has been running for ages.
Yeah.
Did any of the artists you met through that sort of get ushered into the blue grey pink fold?
Yeah, you know the answer to this. Do you?
No.
Yeah, heaps. Like the Beaufort Street Songwriters Club is where I first saw Noah Dylan play, where I first saw Angie Coleman play. Where I met so many people, but like those two in particular are artists that I now manage and work with in a much more bigger capacity, and I saw both of them like stripped down playing like solo as part of the Songwriters Club.
It's a selection process.
Yeah, and it was just because I was like, this is great.
Yeah,
and there's a bit to it too, like there was, you know, the other thing that comes into it, like if I get approached for management or something like that these days, it's like, could I see that other people recognize it was great too? Because you know, I've backed a lot of bands that I loved that maybe no one else really loved that much. And it's been like really hard work to convince people to like something that they don't like. So, you know, you're working with a band where you're like, I can see an audience growing. I can see it building and swelling. It's like, this makes sense. I love it. Other people love it. I should work with this artist.
So is there a bit of give and take with looking at what sort of the public perception of an artist or their music might be, and kind of your gut feeling of like, nah, this rocks, like
there
deserves
is
to be platformed?
It's kind of an afterthought a bit. Like it's like my guts will pretty quickly be like, this is right, and then I'm like, all right, does everyone is there an audience for this? Like what are the realities? Like can I invest, especially in an artist thing now because I'm older and probably made a lot more mistakes, and you know, I've got to make sure my time is valuable. people like Noah and Angie, I'm like, can I invest 5 years and see if this, you know, because it might be 5 years before any profit kind of comes out of it, if that. Or can I invest enough time into this, and is there enough of a crowd already that it makes sense?
Yeah.
Which is like, is a weird thing and a hard thing, because I often think, like, I see bands where I'm like, this band is awesome. Perth is not the right market for it. Could I get it out of Perth? And it's like, I don't know. I don't know if I could.
Yeah, and it can be kind of ugly to, like, talk about musics and art and artists in such, like, economic terms. But you sort of have to. Like,
you really do.
We don't live in a perfect society right now where everybody's just like, hell yeah, great music. Like, you do have to sort of cater to the audience you're given.
Yeah, yeah. You kind of do, yeah. And I think it's going to be a lot easier for the artist if they can, you know, if they have a hometown following that is big enough and successful enough for them to make money here. Because if you can't make money here, it's going to be even harder to try and make money outside of WA.
Yeah, and to kind of bring it back to, I think, the human side of things and not just look at punters as payees. No money on the door of a gig also likely means an empty gig. And an empty gig means none of that beautiful connection for artists, yeah. You know? They're playing to an empty room, possibly bearing their soul, sharing something they've invested a huge amount of time, effort and energy into for no return, intrinsic or extrinsic.
Yeah, and that's hard to watch, you know? It's hard to work with just because it's heartbreaking. And I've been in those bands for years, you know?
So Blue Grey Pink existed through the COVID period, and it's had a massive impact on all art and artists all across Australia, particularly over here in WA due to isolation. What was working through that period like for you and Blue Grey Pink?
Yeah, so I guess because Blue Grey Pink was like encompassing everything I did at the time, it was like it just meant all work stopped, and I just had no, all my contracts just like halted and I didn't get paid, which was terrifying. And then, you know, thankfully that government stuff was good. It was like enough for me to get through. And you know, at the same time I had been really lucky. I'd just done a management course over East like 2 weeks before the lockdown, and that filled me full of like management knowledge. And also, because sometimes being a manager can feel quite lonely, like you kind of, you know, you work really closely with artists, but they, you know, but it's like you maybe don't tell them some of the hard stuff that you've gone through. You kind of try and protect them from some of the crap. So going to that management course was like meeting like-minded people, and I felt like I was a big part of this bigger management community that I didn't know existed. So like, I guess I just had time to just focus on what I'd learned and be a manager. And that was kind of exciting. And it just meant that me and Noah talked heaps, and we stuck with our kind of plan, which at the time he'd been touring and not playing to anyone over East, but we were trying to build up that circuit. And then we just kept putting the songs out. And because I guess people had not putting songs out, they went really well. And his audience grew dramatically, and Blue Grey Pink kind of grew dramatically, and a lot of acts were writing. So, you know, people came out of that lockdown with this energy and all these songs, and we had more releases to put out than I've ever had before. And it kind of was a great time for me in a weird point to be able to just focus on the label and the artists a bit more.
Yeah, and it was quantified as a great time for the label and yourself, at least, because Blue Grey Pink went on to win the 2022 Wham Label of the Year.
Yeah.
Following on from 2020. So you've almost got the three-peat. Just, we'll ignore 2021.
Well, it didn't happen. So I'm assuming we won it by default.
Sweet. Perfect. you know, it sort of learnt throughout the series that awards and accolades are definitely not like the be-all and end-all, particularly for indie labels. But what's your relationship to success as a record label and as an artist? Like, what do you consider success to be?
I just want the artist to be happy with their release and it coming out. Not really streaming numbers, none of the lot of media attention. I just want them to be like, thank you so much. You did a great job. We're really happy. That's all I want with their release. And that is the best I can hope for, really. And also for a release to come out and me feel like I've done the best I could as far as promotion and doing all the publicity and stuff. Because usually that is like the deal's quite different for every act, but most of the time they, you know, take care of everything and we are publicity and promotion for them.
Mm-hmm.
And that is quite hard.
And I think overall that's a pretty wonderful relationship with the ideas of success or failure. I think it's really easy to get hung up on metrics like streaming numbers and plays and likes and stuff like that. But just taking it back to sort of the human connection and being like, no, this was good and we're happy with it. Have you always had that sort of relationship with success, or is that something?
Hell no. Oh. you know, like as a younger artist, I definitely wanted to be like cover Rolling Stone, touring the world stuff. Every artist does at a young age. And it's really hard to, like, I think over the years as you get older, the ridiculous thinking that you're just going to make it, or what, not even really knowing what make it is, comes back to like different levels of like, God, it'd be nice to play to 300 people in Adelaide or something like that. And it got less, and for me personally, because I have a band Odd Law on it, these days I just want like the couple of friends to like it to be an RTRFM, considered for an RTRFM feature album. If it gets that and it gets featured on Bandcamp's New and Noteworthy, I'm like, hell yeah, this album was a huge success. Don't let that influence your decision on that.
Hey, real recognizes real.
Yeah, so it's like, it's always been bad in that. And the hard thing is it's still there, right? Like whenever I put my own music out, I'm like, maybe this song will just fucking shoot up in the air and someone will come along and be like, hey, you're going on tour with us. But that's so unrealistic. But it's still there no matter what I do, that like that hope that that'll happen is still like whenever I put a song out.
I mean, that's the way we're raised in any field, but particularly in the arts, you know.
Yeah.
You're fed what is on the biggest stages, and that's what you aspire to. And it's kind of good. It's wonderful to have that sort of creative ambition, but I think it is important to work within yourself and just have that confidence that if you're happy with something or your collaborators are happy with it,
yeah,
then it's good. But it's definitely something that's hard to learn. Are there any other sort of lessons you've learnt along the journey of running a label, a management company, an email for hire service?
I remember there was a point where I just said yes to every opportunity, and that was good. And then at some point you have to start saying no, and it's okay to say no. I'm pretty bad at saying no still because I said yes for so long. But those yeses led to work. So it's like this balance of like figuring out when you're worth something and being like, no, that's important to learn. And just being able to learn from your mistakes. I like the key to everything.
The classic one.
Yeah. Cause you're gonna fuck up heaps. I've fucked up so much, still screw up things all the time. You just have to be able to go like, ah, that sucks, and figure it out.
Yeah. I think that's wonderful. What's up next for Mark Neal and Blue Grey Pink?
Good question. Well, I do know. We got more releases coming out this year from acts. I'm working on a new Odd Law album. I've got like Angie and Noah constantly working on new music. So that there'll always be heaps of releases to come out, I think. The hard part is like trying to figure out the balance between, because Blue Grey Pink as a label like makes no money. There's not even really a platform for it to make money with releases. Like it's just something we do on the side to help our friends and to put out great music and be supportive to a community, which we think in turn leads to, you know, a better better jobs, probably better aspects for us. So it's not completely selfless. But I think we'll just like that. So that balance is always trying to like, you know, get enough work that pays money and then being able to put out the albums properly or releases properly. So like there's plenty more releases on the cards, like talking to a few acts that want to put out stuff that we haven't worked with before. And then the acts that we have worked with before who are constantly writing and recording. So yeah, so we'll just keep putting out music.
Putting out music properly as well. I really like that, like devoting time and energy and thought instead of just slapping a blue, grey, pink sticker
on something
or
yeah.
whacking it up on Bandcamp or SoundCloud and being like, yep, we've done our job.
Because it's hard, but it's not hard, isn't it? Like, it's like, you know, I know the basic level of like how to put it out and who to send it to, but then there's that little dig a little deeper and find some other niches and places for this record in particular to go. And that's all time. So it's hard. You just got to make sure you've got enough time to do it properly.
Yeah, well, I think you need to sort of know your artists and not just know them in that you're like, you sort of know what they sound like and you know who they'll appeal to. You sort of need to know them as people and have a slightly deeper relationship with them, even if, you know, on paper it still remains professional. There's a really important balance to strike between being just the dude who knows how to do everything and being somebody who knows how to do everything but is willing to do that not because they can or because they want to get a little more clout or because they want to make a little more power, but because they really enjoy the music and believe that it deserves to be platformed, whether that's by the label or by other sort of cultural institutions that the label has access to.
Yeah, yeah. Very well said. Oh.
Do you have any advice for labels or even just creatives in general who want to get involved in the music community and share their music?
Yeah, well, the awesome thing about doing this label, this set series first pressing, has been realizing that almost all of us are in the same kind of boat. Like, we just didn't know what we were doing very well, figured it out, built a community, or kind of knew there was like a little bit of a community growing and found ways to support it without really looking for profits, just to support. So I think like new people coming into it are just going to do it. Like, I don't know if there's advice. They're just going to figure it out. They're going to find community and they're going to do it. I think if people are listening to this thinking, I'm going to start a label, they're probably thinking it because they have a section of artists that they want to work with that they think they can represent, or they see a gap in a market already and they're probably on their way to doing it already.
There isn't necessarily a wrong way to do things.
I guess if you're trying to make a shitload of money, but then again, like, if you do make a crap load of money and the artists get their art out there, then good on you.
Very happy accident.
Yeah.
But yeah, just jump in the deep end. Whether that means uploading stuff just online, higgledy-piggledy, because you like it, or planning out the best way to release things.
Yep. If you spent the same amount of time working at a burger shop as you do on a record label, you will make way more money. So think about that.
Or maybe don't think about it. So it could be kind of grim.
Well, that's realistic. I had this, like, for a little while, I had this really bad habit of whenever I would talk to people, I would try and gauge what they wanted from the release. And I would often say something like, do you want it to be, like, is it just an album for your friends and, like, your little network? Or is it, you know, something you're trying to grow to a national or international audience? And no one would ever say it's just a record for my friends, even though I feel like that's why I do music these days. And I expected people to sometimes be like, yeah, this is just a record for my friends, and I hope, you know, RTR care about it and a couple of other community radio stations care about it. And so I had to stop asking that question. I don't know where this came from, but that was just something that popped into my brain.
Mark Neal, thanks so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure chatting to you about Blue Grey Pink, chatting to you about past bands, future bands.
I thought this was going to be weird, but it actually turns out I really like talking about myself. Just remembered.
Well, you've got an interesting story, and the label's interesting, and I learned a lot from it, and I'm sure other folks will.
Thanks, Matt.
Thanks, mate.
My name is Mark Neal, and I've been your host for all other episodes on First Pressing. It's been a pleasure hanging out with you over this time. I can't thank you enough for listening in. And the biggest and hugest of thank yous to the incredible team behind it. Our producer for this series is Danielle Raphael, with production consultation by Matthew Perrott. Our artwork is by Lyndon Blue, music by Michael Strong. This podcast was recorded and produced on Whadjuk Noongar Boodja. We pay our respects to elders past and present. This land was never ceded. We've had an incredible time bringing you season one of First Pressing. Watch this space. Maybe we'll be back for season two. If not, you'll hear our voices all over RTR FM, bringing you the latest and greatest music from all over the world, including WA and the beautiful music communities that it has here. Thank you for being with us. Thank you for enjoying First Pressing.